This is Tet, 1968. Up until Tet, Saigon had been an isolated haven. Suddenly, the streets of the city were a battleground, and the Viet Cong attackers were not easily dislodged. Sappers blew a hole through the wall of the U.S. Embassy and entered the grounds, killing a number of American guards in the process and tarnishing a symbol of American presence. In the northern city of Hue, Viet Cong forces occupied the center of the city and held their position for over 30 days. Marines at an outpost called Khe San were fighting from fixed positions. The surrounded Leathernecks were outnumbered 4-1 by North Vietnamese regulars. After Tet, American public opinion turned against further efforts to prop up a Saigon regime which seemed cruel, corrupt, and ineffective. The word stalemate and quagmire became current. After Tet, Lyndon Johnson withdrew from the presidential primary and halted the bombing of North Vietnam. Peace talks quickly followed. All historians agree that the news media, especially television, played an important role in this dramatic shift of public attitudes and governmental policies. On the 10th anniversary of the Tet Offensive, a conference was held on the campus of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
We are very grateful for your having consented to come and for giving of your time and of your intellect in this affair.
A variety of perspectives were represented. Retired General William Westmoreland spoke for the military. Douglas Pike and Gareth Porter provided insight into Viet Cong and North Vietnamese intentions. The role of media was discussed by correspondents Peter Braestrup and Charles Moore. While Robert Norshield, producer of the Huntley-Brinkley Report during Tet, provided unique information about electronic gatekeeping. Scholars Larry Lichty and George Bailey shared their research about the impact of Tet stories. Each participant contributed a different perspective, and even though Tet was 10 years past, consensus was difficult to find. Eric Pettigrew helped our film crew. On the last day of the conference, we asked him to summarize some of the concerns felt by undergraduates who attended.
My name is Eric Pettigrew. I'm a Duke student, a senior, and I assisted in helping film the conference, both for myself and both for the filmmaking team as a technical assistant. When I ever think about the Vietnam War, the first thing that comes to mind is a quote by Santayana that says, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." As far as whether or not the media had any effect on me, when I think of the Vietnam War back as it was portrayed by Walter Cronkite, for our family would sit around the table, we would watch the evening news every night. It would finally reach a point where my father would just click it off when the Vietnam War came about. I think the problem was not that there was a paucity of information coming in, but that there was too much information, and that it was conflicting information.
It has been said that the controversy over television coverage of the war is indistinguishable from the controversy over the war itself. As Eric has indicated, there are practical reasons why Americans need to know more about both the war and how it was reported. We have spent over 3 years in our search for insights. Print and television journalists have been consulted. Military leaders and government officials have shared their views. Frontline veterans have been asked to compare Tet experiences with media images. This film has two purposes. First, it will attempt to give you a feel for the trauma of Tet. Along with the sense of a flow of history, the film will attempt to comment on the problems of visual reporting in a time of crisis. As you go through these experiences and listen to different reflections, we ask that you ponder this question, a question as mysterious yet relevant today as during the Tet Offensive 1968. How do we know what we know through visual news? Eric Pettigrew cited the famous insight of George Santayana, "Those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it." With this dictum in mind, the conclusion of our film will attempt to provide some constructive suggestions. We feel that both government and the media made serious errors during the Tet Offensive 1968. We hope that our findings will help our country to avoid future reruns of television's Vietnam.
What makes you think new band spray deodorant will help my campaign for governor?
It's a very small state.
Oh, it's a very small thing.
New band spray protects you from odor. It won't wear off as the day wears on. New band spray.
It's very big.
In November 1967, Johnson called General Westmoreland home from Vietnam with orders to show progress. Johnson's re-election chances turned on victory in Vietnam.
Oh, I don't think for a moment that Westy doubted that there was progress. He brought home both Ambassador Bunker and General Westmoreland to give honest evaluations of the progress that had been made, and there's no doubt that there was enormous progress in 66, 67. In fact, the whole Tet Offensive, if you study the captured documents, was based on the Hanoi's appreciation of how much progress had been made. There is, however, embedded in this question a real issue. I think Westmoreland made an impression. I think Bunker made an impression. And President Johnson, in probably his most effective press conference ever, in which he wore a lavalier mic and talked with great freedom.
I've had three meetings with Ambassador Bunker and three with General Westmoreland. I had coffee with him at length this morning, just before I came here. We believe very strongly in preserving the right to differ in this country and the right to dissent. And if I have done a good job of anything since I've been president, is to ensure that there are plenty of dissenters. I think we're moving more like this. And I think they're moving more like this, instead of straight up and straight down. We are making progress. We are pleased with the results that we're getting. We are inflicting greater losses than we're taking.
Every act is weighed on how it will look on television, how it can be announced on television, and how it will be received on television. I think that government inevitably, for better or worse, is continually looked on as a show.
We take two steps forward and we slip back one. It's not all perfect by any means. There are a good many days when we get a C-minus instead of an A-plus, but overall, we're making progress. We're satisfied with that progress. Our allies are pleased with that progress. And every country that I know in that area that is familiar with what's happening thinks it's absolutely essential that Uncle Sam keep her word and stay there until we can find an honorable peace. And if they have any doubts about it, Mr. Ho Chi Minh, who reads our papers and who listens to our radio and looks at our television, if he has any doubts about it, I want to disillusion him this morning, because we keep our commitments.
He used a microphone which hung around his chest. He used it one time, and everybody thought he was magnificent, far more relaxed. But the next day, the New York Times carried a page one story of Johnson's performance. His comment was, "Now you're trying to make me into a performer, and I'm not an actor, I'm a president, and I won't wear that goddamn microphone again." And he wouldn't.
The public relations campaign worked. In December 1967, more Americans approved of Johnson than disapproved. Officially, there was light at the end of the tunnel. Had North Vietnam gotten the word?
Mr. Jones and Mr. Krempler were neighbors. They each had $3,000. With his money, Mr. Jones bought himself a $3,000 car. With his money, Mr. Krempler bought himself a new refrigerator, a new range, a new washer, a new dryer, a record player, two new television sets, and a brand new Volkswagen. Now Mr. Jones is faced with that age-old problem, keeping up with the Kremplers.
My name is John Kahini. Slide 14 is a picture which was taken outside the 1st Battalion, 26th Marine COC, and it's the picture of myself with the ridgeline to the north in the background and the destroyed tents and one of our open-air urinals. One of the first myths that I encountered when I arrived back in Long Island was that the Marines at Quezon were caught without any warning, or it was the opening of the siege was in somehow a surprise. This was obviously not true. We are quite aware that things were heating up. In that light, slide number one is a picture which I took in early December of Andrew Sibley, the intelligence officer of the 1st Battalion, 26th Marines, his Vietnamese interpreter, Sergeant Lung, and our artillery officer, Lieutenant Smith. They are at the Quezon airstrip awaiting the arrival of a reconnaissance team which had engaged North Vietnamese units. Slide number two is a picture of some of the equipment that was captured being carried by the recon team. As a result of the buildup that we were aware of, the regimental headquarters brought up the 3rd Battalion, 26 Marines, to Quezon. 326 went on an operation west of Hill 881 South and 881 North, trying to locate some of the North Vietnamese units. I was privileged to go on that operation with them as a guide and to assist them in making their way through the heavy elephant grass and hilly areas west of 881 South. I had had extensive experience patrolling that area when I was a platoon commander with Alpha Company. Slide number three is a slide of myself on that operation, walking through the chest-high elephant grass. Slide number four is a picture of Major Caulfield, the operations officer for the 3rd Battalion, 26th Marines, whose accounts of the actual battle of Quezon are quite well publicized. And with him is the executive officer of 326, Major Brown. It was clear after that operation was conducted that we knew that something was going to occur rather soon. However, my conversations with my friends and relatives when I was at home indicated that they hadn't been aware of it at all, which is true. The press very rarely came up to Quezon during those quiet times before the siege.
I used to just go out and reconnoiter. Actually, it paid great dividends later on because of the fact that I had the chance to reconnoiter and to look over the terrain and know where the important key terrain features were and so forth. And we had occupied the hills as more or less outposts. One day we were getting, for the first, one of the first times, really enemy activity. One of the units on the hills, Captain Dabney's company, had gone out on a patrol and they got into a fairly heavy firefight, and we captured a prisoner. And after the interrogators got through with the prisoner, they came over and told me what his story was. And when I after I learned what the story was, I immediately ordered Captain Dabney to come back in to his position. And this is not, very frankly, an easy thing to do with a Marine unit, to have a guy break contact and give up what, a battle that he thinks he's winning. But the prisoner had indicated that, that there was going to be heavy attacks on the base, and they were coming that night or the next morning. So my judgment was, anyway, that, that what I should do is to get my troops in position where they were fighting from sandbag positions and dug in, rather than caught in the open with just digging small foxholes as they could under fire, so I called him back in. And then from there on, it just grew, and as near as I can determine, I guess who knows, but the intelligence reports we get, there were about three divisions around us. I can't even remember what the names of them were, but ended up with three divisions, and it was decided we'd fight a set-piece battle, and then we went from there.
I'd say about between 4 and 5 in the morning. This was either on June 20th or June 21st. I was fully clothed except for my boots, and I was in my little the little bunker that I slept in when I wasn't over in the main command post. The first incoming mortars started raining down on us, and I put on my helmet, put on my boots, and grabbed my gas mask and raced across the terrain there, and still with the mortars were starting to impact on the ammo dump. And this was not an ammo dump with M16 ammo. I mean, it had 155 artillery rounds, 105, Willie Peter, TNT, C3, you name it. If it's in the book, it was probably stored there.
I fell in.
About mid-morning, there was a tremendous explosion. And this, we found out later, was the TNT or the dynamite or some massive catch of explosives in our own ammo dump that had either burned to the point of impact. And it almost collapsed my bunker, although it had huge upright support. And the rounds being blown out of the ammo dump into the, they were actually blown into the gun pits of the artillery crews. And they had to get out there and get those things out of there so they could still function. And it created a lot of problems. It put out the duds and everything that got thrown into the gun pits. They created a hazard, but as best of my knowledge, we didn't have any casualties from this.
I fell in a fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, burns, burns. The ring of fire. The ring of fire.
This particular drawing showing a Marine crouched in a hole during a mortar attack gives me the feeling that, although it's not true, you feel that the enemy is out to personally get you. And that is sort of a feeling that you do experience.
Oh, but the fire went wild. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And
the blackest day of my life was there. Because, you know, it was just a continuous rounds coming in the compound all day long, just one right after the other, you know, and then, you know, you couldn't walk outside because you knew that stuff was coming in all day, and we also took some casualties that day, and of course, that's demoralizing, and but, you know, I even had thoughts of, you know, will I live through this day? And at times, you know, I didn't really care. It was just a very black day. It was just a very black day. Yeah, I knew particularly where all these rounds were coming from, because initially when we started taking the artillery fire, I used to go out and do these crater analyses. I was the only one in the compound at this time that knew how to take a crater analysis and determine which direction the round was coming from. When we took the direct hit, this Major Houchin was the fire direction officer at the time, and I was in the back shaving, and the round landed. And when a round lands, when you take a direct hit and you're in a bunker, it doesn't, you don't hear the explosion so much as the ring. You get a ringing in your ears on a very close hit or direct hit. And I didn't even hear the explosion, but I was back there shaving, and Major Houchin says, Gunny Martin, I want you to go out and make a crater analysis. He said, I don't think you'll have far to go.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
There was a lot of pent-up frustration, and everyone wanted to get back at the enemy, the man on the ground, his opposite number. So there was a great deal of personal heroism displayed every day.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire.
Initially, we were poised for a ground attack, because we felt that the enemy, he felt that he had gotten our ammo dump, which obviously he had, he might have felt that we were very vulnerable. And at that point in time, it probably would have been one of the most opportune times for the enemy to attack. I feel that at that particular morning, that was our weakest point. From then on, things got better.
And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire, the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Suddenly, in the final hours of January 1968, the bottom seemed to drop out.
But suddenly, the last day of January 1968, and then the first few days of February, fighting in cities, fighting the city of Saigon, just a few blocks from the bureaus and so forth, house-to-house fighting. Suddenly, it seemed to have changed from that little far-off jungle war to something, you know, World War II, fighting right in cities. And I think that television audiences, I think people watching on television, probably relate better or understand more or have more feelings about fighting in cities.
The war in Vietnam was kind of a random war. You could not select one day's action and see its inherent importance, say the fall of a town or the capture of a hill. So what television did in particular was to make these little bits, these little isolated chunks of film that they were able to get that day into microcosms of the whole war. It was kind of symbolic journalism. It was kind of almost a ritual in a repeated pattern, almost as ritualistic as the classic shootout in a Western movie.
But let me hasten to say, the offensive at Tet was on a much broader front than we'd anticipated. And I frankly didn't think the enemy would be so foolish as to expose himself as he did. The risk was very great, as proven by the facts, and I just didn't think he'd accept that risk, but he did.
The Viet Cong seized part of the United States Embassy in Saigon early Wednesday, Vietnam time. Snipers are in buildings and on rooftops near the embassy and are firing on American personnel inside the compound. 20 suicide commandos are reported to be holding the first floor of the embassy. The attack on the embassy came as a climax to the enemy's biggest and most highly coordinated offensive of the war. Guerrillas invaded the grounds of the United States Embassy, and some were still there toward daybreak.
TV likes fires. The joke in Vietnam was that if there's smoke in the picture, I can sell it. TV, which is kind of a inadequate information medium because it cannot handle complexity. And the simplistic story of Tet was disaster.
Well, the embassy incident, I think, is a very good case in point. There were a small number of sappers that blew a hole in the wall surrounding the embassy building. They got into the yard, but they didn't get any further. They did not get into the embassy building, but this was reported on American television, despite the fact that when I arrived on the scene, as the last Viet Cong was in the process of being disposed of, I went in the building, I went to the top and walked through every floor. I came down and on the embassy grounds held a press conference and said I had just been through the building, I had just talked to Washington, given them a report, and that there was no enemy in the building and none had entered the embassy building.
The trouble with the camera is that it has beguiling images which are always deal with results and not with causes. The camera doesn't show causes, it only shows results. And it shows the latest beguiling thing. And I think that the camera tends to be a trivializing agent. And that the tremendous dependence on picture stories washes out things that don't represent themselves with pictures.
If I change to Van Roy...
A pall of smoke lay over Saigon, where American and South Vietnamese forces struggled to eliminate stubborn pockets of Viet Cong resistance. The Americans even battled the enemy near the Saigon home of General William C. Westmoreland, the American commander. There was fighting in the Chalon section, where the city's Chinese live, but the conflict was sharpest at the An Quan Pagoda near the Saigon racetrack. Here, via satellite, is a report from NBC News correspondent Howard Tuckner on the battle for Saigon.
The Viet Cong were working their way to the An Quan Pagoda. They were undoubtedly Viet Cong sympathizers. Government troops have captured the commander of the Viet Cong commando unit. He was roughed up badly, but refused to talk. A South Vietnamese officer held the paper taken from the enemy officer. The chief of South Vietnam's National Police, Brigadier General Nguyen Ngoc Lone, was waiting for him.
We noticed that the guy who was in the picture, later a suspect, the Viet Cong supposedly suspect, was picked up, and they were walking him in the direction we were going. And as any good police reporter or news photographer, well, you would photograph any prisoner. It's just in the States, you could pick Baton Rouge or any place else. If a suspect's picked up and he's being walked to a van, you photograph him. And so we just kept following him again because the suspect might take a swing. He might fall down and was going to make a picture. So we just followed him on up to the corner. And we noticed the Jeep on the side there. And we were getting ready to turn for our cars, and all of a sudden, to my left was General Luan. He was then a colonel, the chief of police of Vietnam, of South Vietnam. He came in from the left. Well, I didn't even know who he was. Tuckner didn't know who he was. We had never really seen him before. And he walked over, looked at him without any, reach for his gun. I seen him reach for his pistol. And quite often, covering a war, quite a few situations, to give you a little background, with a pistol or police, they might threaten somebody. You know, there's a lot of threatening going on, putting a gun to somebody's head. So he went for the pistol, which I thought was going to happen. And he aimed it right at him, shot him instantly, and put his pistol back in his holster and walked away. And at the time that he brought his pistol up, I had made the picture, but that was the same time the bullet went through his head. He started walking away, and he said to myself and Tuckner, standing there, he said, they killed many Americans and many of my people. And
you know, walked away, got, took off. Well, we found out later, it wasn't until about a day or a couple days later that we found out that the guy was a Viet Cong lieutenant, and he had killed a policeman from the second story of a building where we, in that area that we were, and they had grabbed him immediately. And he supposedly had papers, you know, saying he was a lieutenant in the Viet Cong. But picture, I had no idea, like, to me, my own feelings was at that time, so somebody got shot in the head, so what? In fact, I dropped the film off in the office. I didn't even stay there to get it processed. I handed it to one of the guys in the dark room. And I said, I think I got this guy shooting somebody, I don't know. And I walked out. In fact, I went to lunch, to be quite honest with you. You become very callous over there.
We had it and we used it. I mean, there was just, at the time, there was no argument about that. There just couldn't have been any argument about it. I mean, it was a remarkable piece of film at a crazy, crazy time. And what its effect would be could not have possibly been predicted.